Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at any time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mester, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Kath. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Myelodysplastic Syndromes. And today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our first speakers, I have a couple of things I want to do. First of all, I want to let you know that we have over 150 participants on this program today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, the Philippines, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call as well. And it's a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Brittany Nick Ragon. And Dr. Ragon is Division of Leukemia, Department of Hematologic Oncology and Blood Disorders, Director of Hematology Operations, Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute, Associate Professor, Department of Internal Medicine, Wake Forest University School of Medicine, Epic Physician Builder. And Dr. Ragon will be addressing discussion of myelodysplastic syndromes and the diagnosis, staging, and current standard of care. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ragon.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's an honor to speak with you all today and to get to discuss something I'm very passionate about, which is myelodysplastic syndromes. In addition to all those titles, I think it's pertinent to point out that I'm a myelodysplastic syndromes specialist and a stem cell transplanter. So I hope to be able to guide you through the diagnosis, staging, and current treatments for MDS today. So I'm going to start with what is myelodysplastic syndromes. And so it's actually a group of conditions that affect the bone marrow. So to give you a sort of level set, the bone marrow is what I consider the most important organ. It helps produce our blood cells. The blood cells of interest are white blood cells, which help fight infection and respond to inflammation, red blood cells, which carry oxygen, and then platelets, which help clot our blood. So in myelodysplastic syndromes, the bone marrow doesn't work quite properly. It usually receives an abnormal signal, which causes the bone marrow to produce abnormal, immature blood cells that just don't function the way that they should. And over time, this can lead to low levels of red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets, and that can subsequently cause things like fatigue, infections, or possibly bleeding. So myelodysplastic syndromes are technically considered a type of cancer because there is that abnormal signal that causes these abnormal cells to arise. But I like to consider them more as a group of disorders that are more on the spectrum of a bone marrow failure disorder. And in some cases, these bone marrow failure disorders, or MDS, can go on to a more serious disease, something called acute myeloid leukemia. So how do we diagnose it? Well, I mentioned that it's a problem of the bone marrow. So the best way to diagnose MDS is to get what's called a bone marrow biopsy, which is where we take a needle and we go into the hip bone, and inside of that hip bone, there's the soft spongy tissue. That is where our bone marrow resides. And the bone marrow biopsy, I think Dr. Sanikamu will go over in more detail, but this helps us determine what those cells look like that can show us these abnormal cells, and also give us information regarding something called genetic testing. So we're all born with 46 XX or XY chromosomes from mom or dad, but over time there can be changes in our chromosomes that lead to an MDS diagnosis. There are also a number of genes which have been associated with the production of MDS, which we're going to go through just a little bit here in a second. So as I mentioned, to diagnose MDS, we do need a bone marrow biopsy, but what would make us think of MDS in the first place? So the typical presentation for patients is that they start having fatigue or tiredness, shortness of breath, and sometimes recurrent infections. One might go to their primary care doctor and get just general blood tests, and on those blood tests, we see these lower blood counts that give us a possible idea that a person may have a bone marrow problem and lead to that bone marrow biopsy testing. Additionally, some patients can have absolutely no symptoms whatsoever, but go in for routine blood work, and we can identify these lower blood counts, which might prompt us to refer to a hematologist and get a bone marrow biopsy. So once we have a bone marrow biopsy, when we look at it under the microscope, we can see these abnormal blood cells. There are also these immature cells that are called blasts, where they cannot mature properly, and this is a feature of myelodysplastic syndromes, and also helpful in how we determine how we treat patients. So the next question I was asked to diagnose is, how do we stage myelodysplastic syndromes? So MDS is actually not like other cancers where we use a staging system. We actually utilize something called a risk scoring system. The most common and historical system we use is the revised International Prognostic Scoring System, and it helps us predict how aggressive the disease might be. This consists of a number of low blood counts, the number and type of abnormal cells in the marrow, and some genetic mutation or chromosomal changes. We put these features into a calculator, and based on these risk groupings, we classify patients as either low, intermediate, or high risk. In the low-risk patients, their disease is likely to progress slowly, and high risk means it could advance more quickly or turn into leukemia. We now have an updated IPSS-M, which is the IPSS molecular, which now includes not only chromosomal changes, but also the genetic mutations, which I mentioned previously. So we utilize these risk groupings to determine how we best approach patients when it comes to care. And what I will say is every MDS patient is unique, which is why it's important that you meet with your physician and come up with your individual risk grouping, the things that are important to you, and also what your treatment might be. So treatment is tailored based on that risk level, your age, your overall health, and your personal goals. For low-risk MDS, the goal is to improve the quality of life and manage symptoms through supportive care like blood transfusions or growth factors. In some cases, we'll use immunosuppressive therapies or medications like lenalidomide. And for high-risk MDS, our goal is to slow the disease and prevent progression to leukemia. This could include approaching clinical trials, which I think is really important for patients with high-risk MDS, and you'll hear about this a bit later. And then we also use gentle chemotherapies called hypomethylating agents, which can help the bone marrow make more normal cells. In addition, in this case, we might consider something called an allogeneic stem cell transplantation as the only potential cure, but an option for younger or healthier patients. So the outlook for MDS can vary widely. Some people live with it for many years with minimal symptoms, but others require more active treatments, but there's a lot of advances in genetic testing and new therapies which can help us tailor our care more effectively than ever before. So it might sound overwhelming, but I hope that we offer some insight today for you all. And working closely with the care team, including our hematologists and MDS subspecialists, is really important in making a difference in your quality of life and outcomes. So I'll thank you for your time and attention, give it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gunn. That was a wonderful presentation, sterling in every way. And really, you're the first speaker, and you've really set the stage for today's program. So thank you so much for that outstanding presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Srinivasa Sanikomo. And Dr. Sanikomo is Assistant Professor, Wake Forest School of Medicine, Department of Hematologic Oncology and Blood Disorders, Levine Cancer Institute, Advocate Health. And Dr. Sanikomo will be addressing the role of hematopathology examination of a sample of your bone marrow in making a definitive diagnosis of MDS and new and emerging treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sanikomo.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for this opportunity to talk to you all regarding MDS diagnosis with the help of hematopathology and also the treatment options, new and emerging treatments. As Dr. Reagan mentioned, bone marrow examination is one of the important tests to make the diagnosis and also appropriately risk stratify myelodysplastic syndromes. And a good hematopathology support is crucial in making appropriate diagnosis. The bone marrow examination will be done under local anesthesia. Bone marrow, part of the bone marrow is aspirated and also part of also biopsied, and that will be sent to the hematopathology for examination. They will be conducting several tests on the bone marrow samples. One of them is morphology, is looking at the how the cells are looking under the microscope, and also they look for any fibrosis or scarring in the bone marrow, and they will be doing a test called flow cytometry to see if there are any abnormal immature cells called blasts, and if there are, how many. And that will be very crucial in making appropriate staging. And also they will be conducting a test called FISH and cytogenetics or karyotyping to look at the chromosomal abnormalities in these MDS cells, because that is also important in making appropriate predictions for the MDS. And lastly, they also will be doing a genetic studies or molecular studies to look at molecular mutations commonly associated with MDS, because for the newest classification called IPSSM, these molecular studies also will be helpful in making appropriate staging. So in summary, hematopathology examination by an experienced hematopathologist is very important and crucial in making the diagnosis and also appropriately staging for the MDS before starting any treatment. As Dr. Reagan mentioned, once we make the diagnosis of MDS, the treatment is dependent on the staging or the risk score, low, intermediate or high, and so having a good hematopathology examination up front is very important. So the treatment options for myelodysplastic syndrome are based on whether we are dealing with a low-risk MDS or high-risk MDS. For most part, low-risk MDS, we try to do supportive care, sometimes just watchful waiting based on how low the counts are, treating the symptoms, and also like giving growth factors like erythropoietic stimulating agents to improve the anemia or the hemoglobin, and based on the chromosomal abnormalities, if there is a 5q deletion identified in the MDS cells, medication called lenalidomide, which is an immunomodulatory drug, is very helpful in treating anemia in that particular condition. There are several newer drugs approved in the last few years. Luspatercept is a medication that was an erythroid maturation agent that was approved a few years ago in patients who have inadequate response to erythropoietic stimulating agent, and it has been later approved as a even as a first line treatment. This is particularly useful in people with MDS with ring sideroblasts or SF3B1 mutation. That is why doing the appropriate molecular studies and also good hematopathological studies will be helpful in guiding the treatment. For high-risk MDS, there are hypomethylating agents that are approved called azacitidine and dacitabine. There is a oral dacitabine called Incovi that was approved for treating higher risk MDS. high-risk MDS, most of the times we consider allogenic bone marrow transplantation in suitable patients. So definitely worth having that conversation with treating providers, and also consideration for referral to a stem cell transplant center for an evaluation. There are several newer drugs being developed. There is another drug called imetelstat. It is another medication that is being approved in MDS and treating anemia in lower risk MDS. And there are several ongoing studies with IRAK4 inhibitors for MDS, and also momelotinib, which is a drug that was approved in myelofibrosis, also being explored in MDS. And there are studies that are going to be started soon in combination with the erythropoietic stimulating agent and luspatercept in lower risk MDS for anemia. So there are several unanswered questions and opportunities for improvement in MDS. So participating in a clinical trial, if there is one available, is always a good option for MDS treatment. So in summary, having a good experienced hematopathologist to review the bone marrow for appropriate diagnosis and staging, and also consideration for a second opinion or opinion with a stem cell transplant center is particularly in high-risk MDS. So I'll stop it there, and I'll be happy to take questions in there. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sanakamo. That was just an outstanding presentation and a very important distinction of the importance of the hematopathology examination of a sample of your bone marrow in making a definitive diagnosis of MDS, and all the new and emerging treatment approaches. I'm sure there'll be many questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Pinkal Desai. Dr. Desai is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Charles Lillian and Betty Newworth Clinical Scholar in Oncology, Clinical Director, EIPM, Molecular Aging Institute, Leukemia Program, Weill Cornell Medicine, Hematology and Medical Oncology, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Dr. Desai will be addressing the role of clinical trials, how research increases your treatment options, and tips to manage symptoms, treatment side effects, discomfort, pain, and quality of life concerns. It is my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Desai.
Thank you, and it's my pleasure to be here and talk about these very important topics. I'll begin with the importance of clinical trials and then move on to symptom management. The first thing I would want to discuss is clinical trials in MDS are available at every point during the journey through MDS, whether that's frontline, the first sort of drug that to be given, including some of these erythropoietin stimulating agents or growth factors that everyone has been talking about. These trials are available at the frontline setting, and also after that, if the treatment in the frontline setting works for some time and then it's time to move on to the next treatment, there are trials available at that stage as well. And generally, clinical trials could be considered in two different ways. You can have access to new drugs. So these are once patients have gone through sort of the standard of care therapy, whether the goal was to improve symptoms and blood counts, or the goal was to sort of prevent progression to a higher stage or leukemic transformation. There are standard of care drugs that are approved, and then once patients go through them, there may be newer drugs that are available at that stage. And this is a way to get access to these newer drugs, because typically when you think about drug development and clinical trial timeline, from the time a drug gets into the clinical trial stage, it can take up to 3 to 5 years to really get to FDA and then be available for the general population to be approved. And the way of getting these drugs earlier is to be part of a clinical trial. And these trials are designed in a way that, you know, there are very strict rules. You're being watched by a team of experts, including doctors, nurses, data people. And most of these newer drugs are going to have some kind of feasibility, and the science is already tested in, you know, previous studies before they come into clinical trials. So these are really vetted, biologically important drugs that can be helpful for patients who have already gone through sort of the usual approved therapy. But there's also what's also important is even for the patient, for the drugs that are already approved, we sometimes are still debating and asking about the best way to use these drugs, whether it's the right combination of drugs or the stage at which these drugs should be introduced. For example, in people who are transfusion dependent, you know, we've always asked this question that should we wait for somebody to be transfusion dependent when we start these drugs, or should we really give it early on before patients become transfusion dependent, and that's the right time to sort of get more patients to respond. But all of these questions are important, and there are trials that are asking those questions. Not only are there new drugs that are in the trials, but also the existing drugs have to be in the right combinations and used at the right stage. And the only way to answer some of these very important questions is to be on a clinical trial. So it's really, really important that when the diagnosis of MDS is made and you're, you know, discussing with your doctor, to always ask what trials are available here at your place or around, so that you can at least have a discussion of what's available, what are the important clinical questions, and how a trial could be helpful to you. The second part I wanted to discuss was just managing sort of symptoms and side effects and understanding quality of life with MDS and on treatment for MDS. Now, symptoms in MDS can occur from, you know, two reasons. One is just the fact that the blood counts are low. If the white cell count is low, there might be a risk for infections and fevers. If the hemoglobin or platelets are low, there would be symptoms related to that. For platelets being low, you could have bruising or bleeding. And for hemoglobin, if you have anemia, then you can have, you know, shortness of breath, fatigue, dizziness, many ways people experience symptoms for anemia. But you also have to understand that MDS is not just a disease of the bone marrow. MDS is it's called myelodysplastic syndrome, so it is a syndromic disease. Patients with MDS tend to have other comorbidities and other conditions that can also cause symptoms. It is a known fact that MDS patients have a higher risk for cardiovascular diseases, autoimmune diseases, even kidney diseases. So some of the symptoms can be from the low blood counts, but it is also possible that symptoms are from other things that coexist with MDS. And understanding that is important. When a patient or someone is diagnosed with MDS, I've always asked the patient, you know, how did you feel 6 months ago? How do you feel now? It helps us understand what part of this is caused by anemia, for example, and what was there for a while. And it's important for patients to understand these symptoms, because many times the beginning for lower risk MDS, for example, observation is appropriate in some conditions where the blood counts are not significantly lower yet, and the patient and the doctors will say, we just want to watch this and only initiate treatment when there are symptoms. So it's important that patients are aware and they're tracking their symptoms, because every time the doctor is going to ask, you know, how much can you walk? Is your shortness of breath worse? So understanding and tracking that is very important, because we do rely on how the patients feel before we initiate treatment. And you know, numbers are numbers. So we say, you know, hemoglobin under 9, you know, you may get symptoms. But the truth is, there are some people who will tolerate a hemoglobin of 7 and be perfectly fine, while there are people who start getting symptomatic at a much higher hemoglobin level. So your symptom management and symptom tracking is very, very important. And also to understand comorbidity. So if there is shortness of breath and chest pain, those can be from anemia, but they can also be from cardiac disease. So taking a multidimensional approach, making sure the heart is checked out, that there are no arrhythmias, all of that is important because you want to start the drug for the right reason. And for that, you have to understand what's from the disease and from what is not from the disease. And what I discussed, all of this is related to sort of lower risk, MDS. When patients have higher risk MDS, usually we are using disease modifying, treatment with hypomethylating agents. And there also the symptoms can be obviously very much related to the MDS. And tracking symptoms on treatment in that situation is even more important. And one thing that's very important to remember is these drugs, can take about 2 to 4 cycles before they work. And sometimes it might feel like the symptoms are getting worse temporarily before they get better. So it's important to sort of discuss this, get transfusion support, but wait a little bit, because if you feel like you're getting more transfusions on these treatments, it doesn't mean that things are definitely getting worse. It's just the time it takes for these, drugs to work. That's truly important for higher risk MDS. For lower risk MDS, again, when you're giving treatments, it's important to know and also track that, okay, if this is the symptom, for example, fatigue, that made the doctor choose the drug and start it, then is it getting better? And if it's not getting better and your hemoglobin's improving and your symptoms are still there, that warrants a discussion, because maybe this is something else and there are other reasons that are causing the same symptoms. On clinical trials, we usually have these quality of life measurements. There are many such scales available where we are tracking patient symptoms, and you could do that on your own, because these are very patient, friendly, and it can be done and used obviously off clinical trials as well. But it's a way for you to sort of keep track on a monthly basis if things are improving or not. But in the end, your symptoms as patients and caregivers for off patients with MDS, you do need to keep an eye on it, track, and always discuss it with your doctor to make sure that your goals of treatment are aligned to what you're experiencing. I think, and in the end, I would just reiterate that, having access to clinical trials, understanding what is the right treatment at what stage is very important, and obviously all of this is tracked, including the symptoms, as part of a trial too.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Desai. That was just a stellar presentation. Excellent in every way, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A too. And our next speaker is Dr. Sangeetha Venugopal, and Dr. Venugopal will be addressing, is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Leukemia Program, Division of Hematology, Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Miami, Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine. And Dr. Venugopal will be addressing key questions to ask your healthcare team during telehealth appointments, guidelines to prepare for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including G-prepared list of questions and discussion of open notes, and next steps after treatment, including follow-up care in collaboration with your primary care doctor and team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Venugopal.
Hi, everyone. It's my pleasure to speak on this topic, because this is very important in the current era, and it as it improves access to the physicians, especially in terms of people who live with MDS and who require treatment indefinitely. So to address the first topic, key questions to ask your healthcare team during telehealth appointments. So first, we need to understand what is the purpose of this visit. Because sometimes what happens is, in my practice at least, if patients are seeing someone else, they come for a second opinion, which is an initial visit. And that's one, if that is the initial consultation for a televisit, then that is a different type of visit compared to the follow-up visit who's already an established patient of mine. So when I offer a follow-up visit for my patient, then I have already seen them and I do know what is their physical status and how they do in general, and a follow-up visit is more like a check-in call rather than the entire purpose of the visit to talk about the diagnosis, staging, and what are the treatments that can be offered. So first, that will be the first question for you to understand what is the purpose of this visit, whether this is an initial consultation or a follow-up visit. And then the next thing is what information you should have ready for the visit. Most often, most of the information will be available to the physician who is offering the televisit because they would have already gone through your chart and they have a fairly clear idea about what is happening with you. But that's not always the case. Most often, some of the key information gets missed, and that information you may or may not be able to tell because those are granular details that would be known only to your treating physician somewhere outside. Or if you are an established patient of the concerned physician, they will already have this information. And if this is a first visit, some of the questions that you will need to ask is, what does this treatment involve? And is this diagnosis correct? So that will be the first question, because you're going to an expert for an initial visit, and the first thing that everybody, including me, will want to do is to make sure this is what we are treating. And most often than not, we repeat the bone marrow biopsy because several studies have shown there is a discrepancy between the biopsy reading if the biopsy is read outside as opposed to if it is read within the academic center setups. Because within the academic centers, we usually ask for the slides to be reviewed in-house, then most often that is enough. But if it is read somewhere which is a standalone lab service or some other institution like that, then we will like to repeat the bone marrow biopsy because the academic hematopathologists are much more, they do have much more expertise than the other folks who see most likely one case would be a lung cancer, and the next case will be a myeloma, and the third case would be an MDS. So in this case, I think it would be important for you guys to ask if you would need a repeat sampling of the bone marrow. And what does this treatment involve? Dr. Sanikomu went over what is the new and emerging treatment approaches. So if this is lower risk MDS, and if the lower risk MDS, if you are in need of treatment, then there are a few options that he mentioned. Either if it is lower risk or if it is higher risk, there is no set duration to this treatment. Unlike solid tumors where you have a set duration and check, in MDS, what we do, we always tell the patients this treatment duration is most likely indefinite, and we continue the treatment as long as this treatment benefits you and you maintain your quality of life, as Dr. Desai was mentioning. And then you will ask about what are the potential side effects and risks of this treatment. If this is a new treatment, or if you have been receiving treatment with another physician, then the other physician would have already updated you. And if the patient is coming to me and I'm starting a new medication, then I am going to go over whatever the side effects that is pertinent to this particular drug. And most often patients ask, when do they need to come for in-person appointments? Let me tell you, the telehealth doesn't actually replace the in-person appointments. So for my follow-up patients, people who are far away, I offer them one telehealth, every 4 months I need to see them in person just to have a physical exam. You may think the doctor is doing a physical exam, probably what is the use of this physical exam, but the doctor has a checklist in their head and they will know what they are looking for, especially when they are doing their physical exam. And it will be once every few months, and the rest of the visits could be televisit. And how often you will need treatment, it depends on what treatment we are going to choose together. If this is for a lower risk MDS who has anemia as the major comorbidity, the treatment will depend on the duration of the drugs that we are, most often they are given every 3 to 4 weeks. And if it is recombinant erythropoietin, it depends on the dose and how frequently we are treating. And if this is higher risk MDS and hypomethylating agents or the standard, which is either azacitidine or decitabine as a parenteral agent or oral decitabine cetacuridine as an oral agent. So in this case, first 6 cycles, we always on time, whether there is count recovery or not, mainly because this is epigenetic treatment and we really need to make sure the treatment catches all the cells in the cell cycle. So for the first 6 cycles, you will need it every 28 days. So then if the first cycle day 1 starts on day 1 and your next cycle will start on day 29, which will be the cycle 2. So each cycle is about 28 days long. So that will be the time duration you will require treatment. And the other thing you really have to ask your telehealth doctor is who will be the next point of contact if you have any questions or concerns during treatment. And what are the specific roles of each member of your telehealth team? So there are a few points I need to make here, and you really need to have you need to understand that not every problem can be solved during telehealth. Telehealth is more for non-urgent issues. And if you have questions during treatment or about treatment, you reach out to your telehealth medicine or your medical team. And if there is EPIC, that is the chart, that is the medical, the electronic medical record that most of us use, you can actually reach out. If you are tech savvy, you can reach out through your MyChart asking for a question. But we should keep in mind that this is not actually monitored in real time, so it will take 1 to 2 business days, and if it is during the weekend, nobody looks over these questions. So these are mainly for non-urgent queries. And if there is some kind of urgency, you have fever, use your judgment and common sense. If you have fever or anything like that, you need to go to the emergency room without waiting for your medical team to guide you. So that is just, you have to use your judgment on that. And you will have, whenever you have a televisit, the telehealth medicine team is going to provide you the numbers to call and how you can contact your physician. Most often, we physician give our email address, and we do have an office number. And again, these email address and office numbers are for non-urgent issues. If you have an urgent issue, I again implore that you go to the emergency room instead of waiting for your answer through the telehealth. Now, moving on to the next topic, which is the guidelines to prepare for telehealth and telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. This is the perfect conference to talk about this. So we, with Dr. Messner and our group of speakers, we actually had a 5-minute pre-check to make sure that things are doing okay, and I was on speakerphone, which I wasn't aware that I was on speakerphone, and it causes an interruption. But it did cause an interruption. So the point I'm trying to make is technology setup is very, very important, and you need to, whenever you are logging in for a telehealth appointment, either if it is a smartphone or if it's a computer, you just need to make sure you have a reliable internet connection and test your internet speed beforehand and check with your telehealth provider which is the platform, either if it is Zoom or Teams or what is the actual platform that you're going to be using, so that you can have it installed and set up. And I would encourage you to join the appointment link at least 15 minutes early to make sure that you don't have any last minute glitches for connection, because this is a very important visit in your healthcare. So I do not want this to be derailed with just technology glitches. So this will help you to have a better visit. And with regards to your prepared list of questions, I do think you need to, I always encourage my patients to have a note and ask them to write out the questions, whether this is a follow-up patient of mine or if this is a new visit, just to make sure that, because not all the time you remember all the questions that you have, and it's helpful to actually make a note of it and ask these questions. And make sure you have your current medication list, and if you are taking any new medications, that includes an alternative medication that is not in the medical list and you're taking over the counter, Or sometimes people can say, okay, you can take this valerian tea for it can cause, it can improve the sleep or something like that. Most of the time, we physicians do not encourage taking the alternative medications, mainly because we do not know how they interact with your current medications. And be prepared to provide details of your medical history, including past surgeries, and especially with family history of malignancies. And this is important, especially for MDS, because we do want to know what is, if there was any family history of hematological malignancy, and if you in particular or if your offspring needs to be tested. And have your pharmacy information with the contact information so that you can, we can, if you are going to prescribe any drugs, we can prescribe it to the right pharmacy. And what are open notes? So open notes, so from in my setup, we always we share the open notes as soon as we finish the visit. Meaning, if your provider is, if your physician is using Epic, then almost all of us actually share the visit after we complete the note. So this, you can see what is our thought process with your disease, and why did we choose this particular medication, and often we will discuss our rationale in this in these notes so that you can also look at it and see if you need to ask any particular questions, or if there is like, okay, if there is, if you think that, oh, why is this treatment being given and not the other treatment, then we can have a meaningful discussion if you are able to read the note and discuss about it. What are the next?
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. And the next step is, because most often we collaborate with the primary care, with your primary care doctor, which is your primary care hematologist in this case. If that is the case, then I personally would email, or my team will email your primary hematologist saying, thank you for the referral, and this is what we think, and this is our suggestion. The thing is, then you already have a primary hematologist and you're coming in for a second opinion. This is our suggestion, and we cannot make we can only suggest this is unless your physician thinks they can follow these directions, then it's hard to actually implement. So that's something you need to keep in mind. And please make sure that you schedule the follow-up appointments with both your telehealth provider and with your primary care hematologist. And to conclude, I would recommend all of you guys to be very proactive in your making in your health, and especially with regards to questions, what to ask, and understanding your treatment plan, and actively participating in your care. And that would be the key takeaway from this talk. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Venugopal. That was an excellent, stellar presentation. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian, Michael E. DeBakey, VA Medical Center. And she will be addressing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. I now turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential in your tolerance to treatment and providing you the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Some patients experience side effects from the disease and or treatment that can impact their ability to meet their nutrition goals. A dietitian is part of your healthcare team and can provide you with specific nutrition information, individualized to you and what your treatment plan is and any other challenges or issues that you're experiencing, as well as other comorbidities. In general, a whole food plant-based diet is recommended during all stages of cancer. Of course, adjusting for any side effects that may arise for your individual needs. But a whole food plant-based diet is when about two-thirds of the plate is covered with a plant-based food. So this could be grains, beans, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, to name a few. What we want to do is eat the food as close to harvest as possible. So, for example, if you're eating an apple, you actually want to eat the apple instead of a bar that has apple in it. The whole food approach is providing a less processed and modified food and giving you the most optimal form of the nutrients that food can provide you. Frozen and fresh are going to be superior to canned for our plant-based foods. And so a lot of times people are surprised by that. Frozen is actually more economical, I find, and it's really superior even to fresh because a lot of our fresh fruits and veggies come from far distances and are picked very early before they're really intended to be harvested. So the flavors are sometimes better with frozen. The other third of the plate should come from a lean protein. So lean protein can be from an animal source such as a white fowl, such as turkey or chicken, fish, it could even be a lean red meat, or it can come from a plant-based food such as a bean, pea, or lentil. It can even come from eggs and dairy, so lots of options for protein. I always tell patients the sooner you connect with your healthcare team about challenges that come up, the better it is because we can help you sooner. And the key to this is knowing your healthcare team and how to reach out to them. So when you're at appointments, ask for people's cards and, you know, what's the best way to contact you and so that you can get your needs addressed as quickly as possible. So there are medications to help with some of the side effects that you experience. And I always make sure when I talk with patients that they're aware of their medications, they understand how to take their medications. Are they getting the outcomes from the medications that they're taking them for? If you're not, talk with your healthcare team. Have them walk through with you. Adjustments are needed sometimes throughout the treatment process. Now, maintaining your hydration is very essential. And sometimes we focus so much on the eating that we forget about the hydration. And dehydration can actually amplify many side effects such as nausea, fatigue, even headaches and making you feel dizzy and lightheaded. Fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, so things like water, milk, sports drinks, juice. A general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day, and some treatments can increase your fluid needs and even decrease your fluid needs, so talk with your healthcare team about your unique needs. So in closing, there are several members of the healthcare team dedicated to you and supporting you during this journey. Please know how to reach out to us and so we can help you sooner rather than later. Thanks so much. I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Thank you so much, Ms. Durden. That was really an outstanding presentation. Just a wonderful talk. Thank you so much. And now it's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ashley Moncrief, RN, BSN, Director of Patient Care, MDS Foundation, Inc., and she is a partnering organization with us today on this program, and we'll be discussing briefly in 2 minutes the MDS Foundation's free national programs and services, its phone number, and website. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Moncrief.
Hello. Thank you so much for being here. I'm very excited to share some of our information with you. So our mission for the MDS Foundation, we are dedicated to improving the lives of those affected by myelodysplastic syndromes through patient support, professional education, research, and advocacy. We strive to empower patients, caregivers, and healthcare professionals with the knowledge and resources needed to navigate MDS with confidence. So a little bit about what we offer our patients. So just to start, everything we do give our patients is always free of charge. We never charge any of our patients or caregivers. We have in-person programs, so we host 6 within the U.S. per year and 1 international. If you're interested in those, just let us know. We have 4 webinars, and if you can't attend those live, we do offer recordings. We have 18 different educational resources that are available in print or PDF download. We have up to 14 different translations, so do reach out if there is a language that you are in need of. We also have digital resources, so some of these are online programs that have video animation or expert content, patient interviews, things of that nature, and some are available as an app on your phone. We do clinical trial awareness, so we're very happy to connect you with whatever trial might be best. We do a podcast report with 4 patient episodes per year. We have a support line. We can connect you to one of our centers of excellence. We have 210 across the globe, and we also have support groups and help other support groups get off the ground. I do invite you to check out our website. It's www.mds-foundation.org, or you're welcome to give us a call. It's 609-298-1033. My personal extension is extension 210. We're happy to help in any way that we can, and I will turn it back over.
Thank you so much. Ms. Uncrief, just a wonderful organization for people living with MDS. Please do take advantage of it. I'm just going to say a few brief words about cancer care. Cancer care offers free national programs and services, mostly delivered by oncology social workers. Our hope line is 800-813-4673, and our website is www.cancercare.org. We offer a host of services from free online support groups. We, for people with MDS also, but all different types of cancer, caregivers, young adults, older adults, LGBTQ plus community. So we really do offer it to all these groups to everybody. We do offer limited financial assistance and we have copay assistance as well. So do visit our website for more detailed explanation of all the services we offer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Kath to go ahead and explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Messer. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So the question for Dr. Reagan, what are the names of some of the current effective MDS drugs? My friend was on Vidazia and that helped for a year.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Sure. I didn't get into the granular details of the drugs, but I'm happy to. There are sort of different groups of drugs. One group of drugs is the supportive care agents, which were mentioned a few times, and those help you produce the blood cells that your bone marrow has a hard time making. And those can include the erythropoietin stimulating agents, that those go by many different names, darbepoetin, Aranesp, et cetera. And then we have other agents like luspatercept and imetelstat. These are all things that try to help you produce cells. We also have some platelet growth factors such as Promacta or Romiplostim. In terms of the chemotherapies that I sort of describe them as helping us clean up the bone marrow, we have the hypomethylating agents that include Vidaza, also known as azacitidine, or its sister drug, which is called decitabine. And as Dr. Sanicama mentioned, we have oral decitabine, so desuridine, for the use of MDS at this point as well. I briefly mentioned a drug called lenalidomide, which is useful in a very specific MDS with something called a deletion 5Q. It can be really effective at restoring hemoglobin. And then just another group of drugs that we sometimes will use in younger folks who have a more immune-mediated MDS. We use immunosuppressive drugs such as cyclosporin or tacrolimus. And I think that covers most of the drug names that you might hear in MDS. And so, yes, it's good to hear that your friend had a response to Vidaza for a year. We love when people have responses to these agents. That's the goal of all the treatments.
Oh, thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Desai. What are your thoughts on seeking a second opinion? I am debating seeking a specialist, but the closest center to me is over an hour away.
Yeah, sure. I think that second opinion, we always encourage second opinions. I think it's always good to hear that people are on board and that there is a specialist in the area or field that agrees and even screens for clinical trials. I know 1 hour seems long, but I think that it is actually worthwhile to make that trip. I am in New York City, so my patients are 1 hour seems very normal for the patients over here. But I think that to make sure that you're getting the right drug, you have the peace of mind in terms of all the options, not just the front line, but everything. It's, you know, MDS is a journey. There's going to be many drugs that are going to be used in one after the other, and it's always good to establish sort of care with an expert in the field, and they can work in collaboration with, your physician or primary care doctor as well. But I think it's worthwhile, and we encourage this a lot. In New York City, we're used to lots of people coming for second opinions, and that's and we work with them.
Much. And a question for Dr. Sanacomo. What advice do you have for dealing with fatigue? I have been taking frequent naps, but it is frustrating for me to lose this time.
Yeah, fatigue is an important symptom in the MDS, and most of the times it could be related to the anemia, and anemia is the most common presentation for MDS. So all these drugs that are described so far, you know, most of them are helpful in managing or improving the anemia. Sometimes so we may have to do the transfusions depending upon how low the hemoglobin is and how severe the fatigue is, and that can sometimes lead to iron overload, and there are medications that can help with iron chelation. But yeah, fatigue is a very challenging symptom, and it may require treatment and like a transfusions depending on severe the fatigue is.
Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Venugopal. Is MDS hereditary? If so, are there no mutations?
So MDS can be hereditary. So that's why I mentioned the importance of family history. There are few mutations that can be inherited and could be passed on to the kids. But most often than not, at least about 80% of the time, 80 to 90% of the time, I would say, all the somatic mutations are acquired and not germline. But if there is a family history of hematological malignancy in younger age, because the median age of diagnosis of MDS is 7th or 8th decade of life, so if there is a diagnosis of MDS or acute leukemia in your family in their 40s or 50s, then that's a segue for you to sort of explore if there is a familial component to your current diagnosis.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to just ask our speakers to give a quick takeaway. I'm going to start with Dr. Rowan, if you would want to give a quick takeaway for our participants.
Sure. I think that my key takeaway for anyone dealing with myelodysplastic syndromes is that we try to tailor your journey to you. It can be very unique. There's no one MDS person or person with MDS that has been the same in my experience, and so it's really important to ensure that you're getting a full understanding of your disease and the potential options, including clinical trials. So there's lots of hope and lots of movement forward in myelodysplastic syndromes, but just make sure that you're being fully assessed as an individual with your own unique journey.
Oh, thank you so much. And Dr. Sanacomo, your takeaway on this call?
So as I mentioned earlier, an experienced hematopathologist is very important in making appropriate diagnosis and staging the MDS. So I encourage everyone to seek a second opinion if at all possible before initiating on treatment and throughout the journey. And there are several drugs that are being approved, and there are several clinical trials. So there is a lot of hope that seeking an expert in MDS at the time of diagnosis and during the treatment course will be helpful.
And thank you so much. And Dr. Desai, your takeaway?
my takeaway would be, you know, always track your symptoms, presenting symptom and any new symptoms, and discuss with your doctor to understand if the treatments are working and the goals of therapy are being met. And most importantly, at any time point a treatment is to be initiated, new or changed, always consider and ask for clinical trials in your area to make sure you're getting the best therapy that is out there.
Excellent. And Ms. Moncrief?
Yes. Our motto at the MDS Foundation, we want to make it to where we know, you know, patients may have MDS, but MDS does not have to have them. It's still your life, and we want to help you live in the best way possible and to be empowered. So never be afraid to ask questions and never be afraid to ask for help.
And could you repeat your phone number again? Someone asked about the phone number.
Absolutely. So we have two. So the 1-800 number, I don't think that I mentioned before, but it's 1-800-637-0839. The other number that I did mention before is 609-298-1035. And then my personal extension will be extension 210.
And I just want to let everybody know that any phone number we mentioned during the call, any website we gave out, you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation in about a week of the program, and all that information will be there in the SurveyMonkey, so just so you know that. It's an evaluation of the program, but it also gives you all the anything that we mentioned during the program that's either a website or a telephone number, or we may want to add something to it as well. Now, have I gotten to everybody? Did I ask everyone, Dr. Desai and Dr. Venipal, did you both get to give a takeaway as well?
Well, my takeaway.
Yes.
So my takeaway would be the patients need to be proactive with their health care, as you are your own strongest advocate. And I echo all my colleagues' sentiments, because MDS is not a sprint, it's a marathon, and at every step of your journey, you need to check in with your team and with yourself that if this is going the right way as you would like to go.
And did everyone get to give their takeaway? Did I miss someone? Or everyone? Okay. I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I also want to thank our participants for asking such great questions. And although we couldn't get to all of your questions, I do want to comment on that. For those of you who got to ask a question, I still recommend that you go back to your treating healthcare team and ask your question of your healthcare team. Remember, you've learned a lot from the program, and indeed, you have a lot to, you may ask the question slightly different, better informed in asking your questions. And then for those of you who are in queue but didn't get to ask your question, please take your question back to your healthcare team. Ask your question of them, because again, they know you the best. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. And I do want to remind you that it seems that we've been hearing this repeatedly from our participants, is that during the day, you're usually able to reach someone on your healthcare team. But evenings, weekends, and holidays seem to be challenging. And as we're coming up to different parts of the country, but different times that might be hard to reach people, be sure you check with your healthcare team their phone numbers for evenings, weekends, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.